You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The recent crisis in our financial system has led many outside the field to question the value of economic models. In his latest book called How Markets Fail, The Logic of Economic Calamities, New Yorker staff writer John Cassidy says that its principles have to be reworked so that it can explain not just market successes, but also the failures. The book is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm pleased that it brings John Cassidy back to our show today. So it was a pleasure to see you.
Thanks for inviting me on, Leonard.
Let's start with the basics. In the current models, is there a technical definition of a market failure?
Yes, I mean, that's the amazing thing. If you actually go and look at the economic textbooks, they all have sections on market failure and when markets don't work very well. But that just hasn't made it through to the policymakers. Basically, a market failure is any type of market that doesn't produce an efficient outcome. If you think back to the whole Adam Smith view of the world, that markets are efficient and that they work to the benefit of everybody, a market failure is when that doesn't happen. For example, in the health insurance market, clearly it's a market failure that 50 million people aren't insured. The market's failing to insure people, which is what it's there for.
Well, has the conventional wisdom, hasn't it been that a market can't fail when people are acting rationally?
Well, I mean, that's what rationality is one axiom of neoclassical economics. The other axiom is competition. And the argument has always been that if you combine people acting rationally with competition, you'll get an ideal outcome. That's the whole basis of Chicago School economics and increasingly between 1980 and 2000, mainstream economics. And that's the argument which I'm taking on. My argument is that competition and rationality can lead to bad outcomes, as they did on Wall Street.
Well, that was Milton Friedman and others.
Yeah.
But what about Ayn Rand, who was a major influence on Alan Greenspan? She believed that people should act out of self-interest. Doesn't that play a role in all
of
this?
Yeah, sure. Self-interest plus rationality plus competition. I mean, Rand is another strand of all this. Greenspan himself was obviously massively influenced by her, was a close friend of her back in the 1950s. The Rand argument, I think, is a bit more moral, based on morality than on efficiency. In Washington and in the UK, etc., other places where these ideas influence policy greatly, the arguments we usually cast in terms of economic efficiency and producing good outcomes rather than morality, which was a big thing for Ayn Rand, of course. She saw capitalism as essentially a very moral system.
Well, one of the people are starting to read again is John Maynard Keynes, but for a long time he was pretty much ignored, wasn't he?
Well, he was, I mean, from like 1940 to 1979, I would say he was incredibly influential and, you know, we basically had Keynesian policies in the US and the UK. Then there was the great free market counter-revolution led in the UK by Margaret Thatcher and in the US by Ronald Reagan, of course, Milton Friedman was the main intellectual influence there. He was an advisor to Reagan. And Friedman, of course, was the man who took down Keynes. He provided an alternative monetarism, saying Keynesian policies didn't work. And, you know, we basically got a new conventional wisdom based on Friedman's ideas rather than based on Keynes's ideas.
But this isn't just a Republican thing, because although Reagan and Thatcher were really the major proponents, didn't most of the deregulation take place under Jimmy Carter's administration?
I mean, sure, it wasn't. It began as a partisan movement and growing out of the right. But the power of the ideas was such that it basically took over all the it took over the Democratic Party in the U.S. As you say, it was the Clinton administration that put through the crucial deregulation reforms in the late 1990s. And the Treasury Secretary at the time, Lawrence Summers, was an economist who, at least in his early years, you know, had some Keynesian tendencies.
And Alan Greenspan was at the Fed, and
right.
He was credited with working very well with Bill Clinton.
No, sure. I mean, there was a consensus. Same in the UK. You know, the whole Blair movement was basically based upon accepting the settlement which Mrs. Thatcher had imposed on Britain, a much more free market settlement. There was basically an intellectual counter-revolution, and it dominated all the parties.
Now, it's called the general equilibrium model, isn't it? What are the tenets of the equilibrium model?
Well, there's the general equilibrium model, which I devote a chapter to in the book, is pretty complicated. That's the sort of formal theory of how free markets works. It's a mathematical model of the economy, which purports to show that you can logically prove that free markets work efficiently. What does efficiently mean? It means it produces a solution in which it's impossible to make one person better off without making somebody else worse off. And you can actually, thanks to work that was done in the 1940s and 50s, you can actually derive this mathematically if you've got higher mathematical skills than I possess. So I go through all that. The problem with it, of course, is that it's based on some very unrealistic assumptions, such as the idea that everybody has perfect information about the future, that there's no monopoly power, there are no Microsofts, no Googles, which clearly have monopoly power. You know, it's an idealistic system.
And it also calls for no government intervention or minimal government intervention.
Well, in the actual formal models, there is no government sector. So, yeah, it's basically a mathematical idealization. The people who invented actually were very upfront about that, but it sort of got perverted and popularized into the idea that you could actually prove that free markets worked well all the time, which you can't.
Before the meltdown, was it possible to see that this model wasn't actually explaining the way the market was working?
Well, I think it was. I mean, you know, that's what I've been writing about the last 15 years at the New Yorker, various ways in which the market doesn't act in the way the textbooks say it should. For example, I return to healthcare. You know, there have been problems in the healthcare market for decades. That's not anything new. Global warming and pollution.
But wait, I want to stop with healthcare for a moment.
Okay.
Because there are still people in Congress who are arguing that this is the best system in the world.
There are people arguing that, but I mean, you know, if you just look at the figures, the U.S. spends more money on healthcare than, I'm sure everybody knows this, and the U.S. spends much more money on healthcare than any other developed country. And if you look at the health outcomes, it has some of the worst health outcomes of any developed country. To an economist, if you look at that, that's saying there's a lot of resources being poured into this. You're not getting very good outcomes. That means it's an inefficient system. Now, there's just no way around that. You know, you can argue what would be better. You can make the argument that perhaps the government system would be even worse, and that's a legitimate argument. But to argue that the current system is an efficient system, I think, is just nonsense.
My guest is John Cassidy. His latest book is How Markets Fail, The Logic of Economic Calamities, and it is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. You propose replacing the utopian economics model with reality-based economics. How do each deal with the uses and limitations of markets?
Well, I mean, I came up with the phrase reality-based economics, but I don't claim to have invented this stuff. I mean, that's one of the great untold stories here, which I tried to tell in the book. There is another branch of economics which is perfectly mainstream. People have won Nobel Prizes for it over the last 20 or 30 years, which takes the sort of failures of markets seriously, explores how they come about because of information problems, because of herd behavior. For example, on Wall Street, one of the big problems is that people don't necessarily just buy things for their intrinsic value. They buy them because everybody else is buying them and they think they can make a quick speculative gain. That is very damaging to the sort of idea that, you know, markets work rationally and efficiently. And there's a whole literature out there which I explain, which you can apply to healthcare, you can apply it to global warming, you can apply it to Wall Street, and it just shows, you know, here are the sources of how markets fail, and it also points you towards some solutions.
Well, because Ben Bernanke is a scholar of the Great Depression,
right.
We read many times that he was better prepared to handle this crisis.
Right.
But I've always wondered about why we weren't paying attention to the Great Depression when we were seeing certain similar things develop in our economy.
No, as you say, sure. I mean, there was the whole sort of hands-off movement towards Wall Street.
Where was Bernanke on that?
No, he was completely behind the curve. I mean, I think he would even admit that. In fact, I think he said in an interview that I did with him a year ago now that you know, he was slow to realize what was going on. I mean, Bernanke is an interesting case because he sort of sits in the middle of this whole debate. On the one hand, he had a very traditional economics upbringing, and he's a big fan of Milton Friedman. He takes seriously all the free market models. But on the other hand, as you say, he was a great student of the Great Depression, so he realized that if things go bad, they can go very bad. But somehow that didn't click in his mind with what was happening in 2002, 2003, 2004, etc., in the housing market and in subprime mortgages. When he finally realized that this was really a threat of the Great Depression, I think he reacted very strenuously, and the Fed interventions did prevent a much, much worse outcome. So I think, you know, it's a bit of a story of two halves to adopt a soccer metaphor with Bernanke. He had a bad first half, but a good second half.
Although some people are arguing that it's been a good second half for the markets, but little else?
Well, so far it's not really fed through into much of the, certainly in terms of employment, but the economy is growing again. I mean, I take a slightly different view of this. I think what we've had is incredible government intervention, enormous government intervention in the economy, both on the monetary side. The Fed has been pumping money into the financial markets, and it's been acting as a lender of last resort, lending to firms that couldn't get money. Then we've had a big stimulus program. These are both sort of classic, not necessarily Keynesian, but they're classic old-fashioned economic management initiatives. And they've worked. They've worked very well. I mean, they've not brought the economy back to where it was 2 years ago, but nobody should have expected that. They've headed off a much worse outcome. But somehow, I think, what's been lost is this idea. I mean, if you talk to people in Washington or if you just read the op-eds, you get the idea that the whole financial crisis was somehow a government failure rather than a market failure. It's been a brilliant sort of rewriting of history by the right, I think. And I don't think the administration and its supporters have done a very good job of explaining that actually this was a big market failure, and without the government, it would have been a lot worse.
Well, the right is claiming that we're putting too much money into the economy, and people like Paul Krugman are complaining that we're not putting enough in.
Right.
Are you suggesting we're just right?
Well, I'm not saying we're just right, but we have quite a big stimulus program, and some of it, I mean, I think, one of the things Krugman hasn't pointed out is that actually most of the stimulus spending, or perhaps he has, but I've missed it, most of the stimulus spending is going to take place in the next year or so. We've only had a little of it so far, so it's not that surprising that it hasn't given the, hasn't brought unemployment down from 10%. I'm thinking more, though, in terms of the whole government intervention in the financial markets, which I think was very necessary at the time. The problem with it is we've now set up this whole too big to fail problem, which is really a version of crony capitalism.
You say market failures are endemic. The current crisis feels like an epidemic.
Well, I think it felt like an epidemic a year ago. Does it still feel like an epidemic? Maybe it does if you've just been made unemployed, obviously.
Well, or over 10% unemployment.
No, sure. I'm not trying to downsize that problem in any way. It's obviously the deepest recession since the 1930s. But a year ago, it looked like it might be, a repeat of the 1930s when we had 25% unemployment.
You say that in the past 40 years, there have been 124 systematic banking crises throughout the world. Some of them have been quite serious. The Asian one was quite serious.
Sure.
When this started happening, people were citing that as the closest precedent.
No, it's true. I mean, that's what's actually, in retrospect, is sort of amazing about the whole Greenspan view of the world, that financial crisis we didn't have to worry about, and that the chances of a breakdown in the financial system were negligible. That may have looked true based on the sort of recent history of the U.S., although you could argue that there were big problems in the early 90s and in the 80s. But if you looked around the world at other financial systems, as you said, there have been hundreds of financial crises, including some very serious ones which have produced deep recessions. So given the policies that were being put into effect here, it was only a matter of time before we had a financial crisis.
Well, we did have a few others. We had a major recession in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, sure, we did. I mean, I think the 70s wasn't...
We had the dot-com bubble burst.
We did, but that's the interesting thing. The dot-com bubble, it burst, but then Greenspan's policies actually worked to some extent in that he reduced interest rates to very low rates and the economy came back pretty quickly, so it was actually a relatively shallow recession. That, in retrospect, was very bad for the economy because it encouraged the Fed that it didn't have to worry about speculative bubbles and financial crises, because it could always, the phrase they used, they could always clean up after the mess. Well, it turns out if the financial crisis is big enough, it's very difficult to clean up after the mess.
John Cassidy has written a book called Dot-Com, How America Lost Its Mind and Money in the Internet Era. He writes regularly for The New Yorker. He's also a frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books. And his latest book is How Markets Fail, The Logic of Economic Calamities. It is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and we will continue our conversation after this. Back with John Cassidy, whose latest book is How Markets Fail, The Logic of Economic Calamities. It is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Do business schools need a new set of textbooks for teaching principles of economics?
Well, obviously they need mine, Leonard.
You'd like to see this become required reading.
Required reading, yes.
At Harvard Business.
Every business school in the country and the other ones around the world, of course. No, to, you know, obviously that's a joke. But
how are they taught, market failures taught now?
Well, they are, in a lot of cases they aren't. I mean, it depends. Obviously, at good universities, if you major in economics, you will do the sort of free market economics for a couple of years, and then there will be courses in, you know, there will be elements of the courses which deal with market failures. I mean, one of the things I point out in the book that actually, if you look at some of the more recent research in economics, there are whole new schools of economics which do question the old model. There's behavioral economics, which explores how irrational behavior impacts the economy. There are models of how so-called rational herding models, how it can be rational to act like sheep on Wall Street, to, you know, to sort of surf bubbles, etc. These academic developments have existed for years. They just, for some reason, they didn't have much impact on policy. And to be honest, you don't really get taught them in the basic courses you get in economics. You know, if you just have a basic economics 101 course, it usually is pretty much mainstream free market economics.
I've spoken to a few of those economists who said they were treated as Cassandras at the time.
No, that's certainly true. I mean, I've been very critical of the economics profession over the years for it. But, that may be true in all professions. There's a ruling set of ideas which the people at the top of the profession have created. Obviously, it's in their self-interest to keep those the ruling ideas. It certainly was
for the last 40 years.
Last 20 or 30, yeah. I mean, it certainly was difficult 10, 15 years ago to get dissenting articles published. I think it's less difficult now because of the rise of behavioral economics. Some of the behavioral economists are very senior and are editing some of these journals, so it's easier than it used to be.
How would Marx, who understood the workings of capitalism quite well, have interpreted all of this, do you think?
That's a good question. I mean, I think...
The reason I ask is because you wrote a wonderful article on Marx as someone who really understood capitalism. He wasn't so good at coming up with his own system, but he really did understand capitalism well.
Right. Well, Marx was actually... obviously, in the 19th century, when he was writing, the financial system was much more rudimentary than it is now, so he didn't know anything about subprime mortgages and derivatives, etc. But he did actually have some sections in his work about the role of credit in the economy, and he did warn that, you know, excessive supply of credit can produce a crisis because banks and other financial institutions get into trouble. Actually, that was a pretty common view in the 19th century. It wasn't just Marx who said that. Even the free market economists of the 19th century, like J.S. Mill, and even going back to Adam Smith, they didn't try and apply their free market ideas to banking. If you go back to Adam Smith, he has a whole section on how banks can cause a great deal of trouble in the economy by extending credit to people who don't deserve it. The people then can't pay their loans. The banks get into trouble. That leads to a contraction of credit throughout the economy and a recession. That was the theory of the trade cycle. That was completely forgotten in the sort of 1980s and 1990s. But as I say, in a lot of cases in economics, if you go back and read the so-called old masters, they had sort of more realistic views of things.
Did the old masters believe in regulation?
They did believe in regulation of the financial sector. As I say, even Adam Smith has a section which I quote in my book, in which he says, yes, regulating banks goes against the principle of free exchange and free markets. But in this case, it's justified because the damage that can be done if you don't do it is too large to ignore.
It's interesting that there were immediate calls for regulation, but I haven't seen any serious legislation proposed.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the thing. We've at the moment we appear to have the sort of the worst of all worlds. I think we've maybe not the worst of all. One of the worst of all worlds. The worst of all worlds would have been a return to the 1930s. But what we've got these we've bailed out the big banks, and now we've got these enormous financial institutions like Citigroup, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, which everybody knows are not going to be allowed to go bankrupt or fail. That's the so-called too big to fail doctrine. The government tried letting Lehman Brothers go bankrupt. The entire financial system nearly collapsed. So everybody knows we're not going to do that again. People on Wall Street know that. So they've effectively got a government guarantee these big financial institutions, which gives them a great incentive to take risks, because if things go well, they get the benefits. The stock options of the senior executives go up and the shareholders do well. If things go badly, the government is going to come in again and bail them out. That's a very...
A win-win situation.
It's heads I win, tails you lose for them. So... You know, if you're going to accept that, and some people on the right would say, well, we should just let them go bankrupt. But that's really not a very credible thing to say, because we tried that before and didn't work. So it seems to me if you know, there's got to be a quid pro quo for the government guarantee, and the quid pro quo has got to either be in the form of tougher regulation or some sort of breaking up of the banking system to deal with this too big to fail. As I say in the book, government guarantees without any form of regulation really isn't free market capitalism, it's crony capitalism.
Wouldn't the push for that come from the White House? President Obama's top economic advisor, Larry Summers, says he learned a lot from Alan Greenspan, and he's also a believer in the stability of markets.
Yeah, I mean, Larry's a very interesting case. I mean, he started out as a sort of neo-Keynesian economist and did some very good work on how financial markets can get out of whack with reality. When he became Treasury Secretary, he, as you say, sort of seemed to move to the right and said nice things about Milton Friedman and free markets.
And he put the Clinton-era bill combined commercial and investment banks through.
Well, he was the Treasury Secretary when that went through. It was actually an initiative started out before him by Bob Rubin's time.
Okay, well, Bob Rubin is also... Right now in this administration.
No, exactly. But, I mean, Larry has now said, I mean, he gave an interview to the FT in which he said, like Keynes, when the facts change, my opinions change. And the administration has put forward some proposals, for how to regulate things. The problem is, I think they made a strategic error a year ago when Wall Street was basically on its back and was asking the government to rescue it. The government could have asked anything of it at that stage. It should have said, yeah, we'll bail you out, but here's the three things we're going to ask for in return. You're not going to be allowed to do this, that, and the other. And they could have, pressed it through right then and there. But at the time, they didn't want to do that. They were so worried about the financial system would collapse that they basically gave the Wall Street the money without imposing a settlement. Now, a year later, the government doesn't really have any leverage. The financial system's back on its feet. These banks are making a fortune again. Their lobbyists are, going up and down Capitol Hill saying, oh, you can't do anything to diminish our profits, etc. And so you get Tim Geithner and Larry Summers making speeches saying, this is outrageous. We bail these guys out, and now they won't support regulation. I think that was, a political error. We should have imposed that at the time.
The only thing that they realized they couldn't do is have expensive retreats and fancy dinners at expensive restaurants.
Well, I mean, that's for the people who still...
And now they're back to bonuses.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have anything against bonuses. I mean, if these companies make a lot of money and if the bonuses are tied to genuine profits and they're spread over the long term... I think that's fine. The problem is, obviously, if they're making money, basically on the back of taxpayers, and at the same time are, taking risks which could bring down the entire financial system, that obviously is, completely unacceptable.
Well, the public seem to be feel that the problem with bonuses was that the people who were responsible for all the problems. And in some cases were in companies that were losing money, were still getting multi-million-dollar bonuses.
Right, sorry, I spoke loosely there. When I said I don't have anything against bonuses, I mean I don't have anything against well-structured bonuses. The bonuses that were handed out on Wall Street in the sort of bubble years were just, if the stock went up just with the rest of the market, etc., you got an enormous payout. So basically, managers were being paid for surfing the stock market bubble and the credit bubble. If you gave people bonuses which didn't vest for 10 years, so that if they'd taken irresponsible actions by the time their stocks had came to vest, we'd seen the consequences. I think that would be much better. I mean, my worry is I'm all in favor of reforming bonuses, but I think. All the political emphasis on bonuses misses some of the sort of more important underlying structural aspects which haven't been addressed, such as, whether banks should be allowed to take big risks with their own money, whether there should be some return to Glass-Steagall, etc. Focusing on bonuses is politically attractive, but it doesn't really tackle all the underlying problems.
My guest is John Cassidy. His latest book, How Markets Fail, The Logic of Economic Calamities. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Bonuses are not the big issue. Ponzi schemes are really not the big issue, even though they get a lot of focus. I get a feeling that geckoism was the biggest, was a major problem. Michael Douglas was on the show, and he told me that he was horrified. He'd go to a nice restaurant, and somebody would come up to him and say, "You're my hero." He was the villain of that movie.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is interesting. It's certainly the case that, let's be honest, that's why people go to work on Wall Street, because they want to earn a lot of money. I mean, it's self-selecting. people who are very interested in, you know, in getting rich, where are you going to go? You're going to go and try and work at Goldman Sachs or Lehman Brothers at Bear Stearns, because that's where the money is. It's like the old Willie Sutton joke. So my argument is that, you know, that's been true forever. Greedy people have always gone to Wall Street. Greed has always been there. What is different? What's been different in the last few years, which has allowed that greed to produce an economic implosion? And that's why I say, I think, you know, the, in some ways, greed is good in that, you know, if we harness these incentives to the benefit of everybody, then, you know, it can work. It certainly gets people out of bed on a morning and, you know, produces hard work. The question is how you structure those incentives so that it rebounds to the benefit of everybody and not just the people concerned.
You say that using game theory to explain the crisis works better than general equilibrium theory. How does game theory apply here?
Well, I don't want to get too technical, but if you think game theory is based, general equilibrium theory is based on the idea that there are so many people involved in the markets, etc., that no one person can have any impact. What I go out and do in the stock market tomorrow is not going to impact what happens in the market.
Don't people watch Warren Buffett?
Well, exactly. Well, my argument is that actually a lot of people on Wall Street, they do react to each other. The basic model you need when you're thinking about how markets work and how banks work, etc., is one in which a relatively small group of people are competing against each other, and what they really care about is if you're at Goldman Sachs, what you really compare about is how you do compared to Morgan Stanley or Merrill Lynch or whatever. And if you're looking at how small groups of people interact, the only theories we have available are game theory. The particular one I refer to in the book is the prisoner's dilemma, which is a version of game theory in which people acting rationally in their own self-interest produce a disastrous collective social outcome. That's something I refer to as rational irrationality.
While you advocate change, you also say that the Fed needs to go back to its traditional role. According to a former Fed chairman, William McChesney Martin, the Fed's role is taking away the punch bowl just when the party gets going.
Right.
But that's no longer the case. It hasn't been for a while.
Well, it hasn't been since Greenspan took over. I mean, I think under Paul Volcker, the previous Fed chairman, Volcker was an old Wall Street guy and had a more realistic view of the markets than Greenspan did. But then it's not just Greenspan. Central bankers all around the world since the 1980s have basically taken this view that the markets are self-equilibrating. It's a stable system. You don't have to worry about speculative bubbles, etc. I think, and I hope, that view has now been discredited. But, it's like Count Dracula. You have to put a stake in it. I'm not sure it's quite dead yet.
Well, how would a laissez-faire capitalist explain a check on subprime lending?
You mean how to restrict it?
Yeah.
Well, you wouldn't. If you're a complete believer in laissez-faire, you don't believe in restrictions on anything as long as they're
even when it leads to disaster.
As long as they're legal. Well, as long as it's, if you could foresee it's a disaster, then you would put a law against it. But the argument for laissez-faire is that most legal actions, rebound to the benefit of the community. Now, it is dangerous to start prescribing things, you know, just on the basis that something might happen. But as I said, this is not a new idea. We've had restrictions on credit. Most economists have known for centuries that credit is dangerous. You know, it's like a liquid. It's like fuel. It can produce a conflagration if there's too much of it around and if you spray it all over the place. So that's why, as I say, people like Adam Smith and the old free market economists, even Milton Friedman, you know, they looked for limits on credit creation. Friedman's idea of restricting the money supply was a way of restricting credit creation. It was people who went even further than Friedman in saying the markets would, could look after themselves, like Greenspan, that got us into trouble.
A lot of people have been arguing that the current situation, the current approach, is just a giant Ponzi scheme. And I even see that now they're calling the healthcare reform another Ponzi scheme.
Yeah,
are these Ponzi schemes? Well, it seems to me then all of insurance is a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, I don't think that's. I mean, the phrase Ponzi scheme has been misused. Obviously, the Madoff case has brought it back into public usage. I mean, a Ponzi scheme is basically you use the current receipts to pay out the current people who are demanding things.
Social Security has been doing that for a long time quite successfully.
That is true. The question is, Ponzi schemes work if you can be assured that the future revenues are going to meet the future needs. That's not really a Ponzi scheme. The Ponzi scheme, it must involve an element where you know that the future revenues are not going to be able to meet the future demands because you're not investing it. You're just handing it out. There are no real investments. Social security schemes, at least theoretically, are based on the idea that, you know, you've done your actuarial analysis and you make sure that the future revenues are going to be able to meet the future needs.
Just one more question from a listener. What is it going to take for us to learn? Because it's obvious that we keep on developing amnesia. We have a Great Depression. We come up with solutions, and then later we're assured that we learned an awful lot from the Great Depression. It could never happen again, and then it happens again.
Well, I mean, you know, these things are cyclical. I think it was the historian Sorensen who, you know, produced the theory of you need things go in life cycles. You have to wait until people die before, you know, people, the next generation, learn the lessons. I think there is something in that. We'll learn for a while. We'll learn for a few more years. But, you know, that's how capitalism works. Then we'll get another wave of optimism. There'll be some new object of speculation, and we'll have another boom. You know, if you go back over the last 200 years, that's just happened at regular intervals. It seems to be an inevitable part of the system. Doesn't mean we can't try and dampen it down. We did a pretty good job of dampening it down from the 1930s to the 1980s. But most of the restrictions and the safeguards which were put in place then were subsequently, you know, abandoned, and that's what got us into trouble.
I'm predicting that the next big bubble will involve tulips.
Tulips? Well, we've tried that before in Amsterdam back in the 17th century. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, there's no intrinsic worth to any of this stuff, you know. I mean, you can... who's to say, really, whether a house is worth $200,000 or $800,000? What we've learned in the last few years is both prices can seem perfectly rational and reasonable at the time. You know, it's not a matter of just counting the number of bricks and mortar.
John Cassidy's book is How Markets Fail, The Logic of Economic Calamities. It's published by Farris, Strauss, and Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks very much, Leonard. I enjoyed it.